Next case on the court's docket is LaDon Shreves King in Commonwealth of Virginia.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'm Amy Wilson, and I'm here on behalf of LaDon Shreves King. She's the appellant and petitioner in this case on one assignment of error. That is that the trial court erred in failing to properly instruct the jury in this case on the issue of accident.
Did you want to reserve any time for rebuttal, ma'am?
Yes, Your Honor. 3 minutes, please.
Thank you.
Thank you. The issue of accident in this case, Your Honors, was the sole issue that the defense raised in this case. It was their sole and vital defense, and it was sufficiently supported by the evidence at trial. Although the Commonwealth's theory was that the shooting in this case was malicious, the defendant's entire testimony, as well as other significant evidence in the trial, support the defendant's theory that the shooting was accidental. Your Honors, I don't believe there's any significant dispute in this case at all about whether the evidence was sufficient to raise the issue of accident. In fact, Judge Kasabian at the post-trial motions
basically teed it up for you for appeal.
He did, Your Honor, and I did appreciate that. He specifically said that while some may have granted an instruction that defined the difference between intentional and an accident, intentional act and accident, he didn't believe it was necessary. He said, while one could have given the instruction for action, I do not believe it was necessary.
And I gather that the trial court decided that there was a negative implication that the jury could reach and that was sufficient for an instruction on your theory. Why is that wrong?
I'm not sure about Your Honor's question. The negative implication?
Well, and that's my terminology, but it strikes me that the trial court was saying that your theory is adequately presented in instructions by negative implication from what arises from the Commonwealth's instructions.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is my characterization correct? And if so, why is that error?
Well, Your Honor, I think that the case of Bryant versus Commonwealth is instructive at 216 Virginia 390, where the court specifically states that instructions should be simple, impartial, and clear and concise. And I think the impartiality is really what we're getting at in this issue, because the instructions were replete that were presented to the jury with negative inferences, as your Honor stated, that it had to be an intentional act, that it had to be a deliberate act, that there had to be malice. But what is never mentioned is what the jury for the first time mentions in its question, which is the distinction between whether it was an accidental or intentional shooting.
But in our cases, both from this court and from the Supreme Court, the standard is that we cannot consider or assess the applicability of a particular instruction based upon a jury question, because it may be just one juror who has this in his or her mind as to the importance or implication of it, and not necessarily tipping off to the court the significance of a particular issue.
You're absolutely right, Your Honor, and we wouldn't be here just because of the jury's question. And even if the jury hadn't asked a question, we wouldn't be here. But what the jury's question does for the court, and did for the court in that case, and certainly we're hoping will do for Your Honors, is that it puts a spotlight on exactly what was lacking in the instructions and what was replete in the evidence. And the jury didn't know what to do with the distinction between that. There was nothing about accident and instructions, yet they're asking, what is the difference between an accident and an intentional act? The specific question for the jury said specifically that if a weapon were discharged during a struggle or accidentally, would this constitute a shooting with intent to kill, etc., as stated in element 2 of malicious wounding? The judge then answers, or asks us, the counsel, actually, really just asked the Commonwealth, didn't want to hear from defense on it, knowing what our position was. What is the downside?
Poor Judge Kasabian not here to defend himself. Goodness gracious.
What is the downside of instructing this jury that an accidental shooting does not constitute a shooting with intent to kill or permanently maim, disfigure, or disable? What's the downside of that? That question was never really answered, and the court didn't go on to say, well, I believe the downside is, or I find the downside is. Instead, the court just said, you know what, I'm just going to give them this answer. You must rely on the instructions previously provided and give the words their ordinary and plain meaning. And that was the end of it, and that was the instruction given. And then, nonetheless, after the jury came back with its verdict and we filed post-trial motions, the judge acknowledged a different judge may have given a different instruction. What, in Chesapeake, in York County, somewhere else, a different judge, or one of the many judges in the Fairfax County Circuit Court, Don King could have had a different jury instruction given, a potentially different verdict, not resulting in an 8-year sentence for the shooting. I don't know how justice is carried out.
And I appreciate your argument, and it's a very good argument. I find the case very interesting, but what is our standard of review?
Your standard of review in this case, Your Honor, is to review the trial court's refusal and to give the defense proffered instruction in the light most favorable to the movement.
I understand the basis or the standard for reviewing the applicability or appropriateness of an instruction, but on review, is it an abuse of discretion as to whether or not the trial judge failed to give an appropriate instruction?
We would submit, Your Honor, that the only way to review, the court has a responsibility to see the law has been clearly stated and that the instructions cover all issues fairly raised. And I think in order to do that, you have to review the evidence de novo.
But doesn't Judge Kasabian sort of, noodling it in his own mind as to whether or not he was going to give the instruction or not sort of highlight the abuse of discretion standard? In other words, as you said, one judge might give it, another judge might not, another judge might split the difference. Another judge might tell the jury, you know, just rely on the instructions that I give you or whatever. And so what we're going to do as an appellate court is essentially say, okay, Judge A may have been right, Judge B may have been right, but as long as neither one of them abused their discretion, we're going to uphold it on appeal.
Your Honor, I do not believe that an abuse of discretion standard is appropriate in this case. In any case where your review, the standard of review requires the appellate court to see whether or not the issues raised at trial that match the law that was given to the jury, you have to review the issues fairly raised. You have to review all of the evidence, and you have to review it to see whether or not the judge made an appropriate decision and whether or not in giving the proper instructions to the court.
Well, so long as it's supported by at least a scintilla of the evidence, when viewed in the light most favorable to the defense, the proponent of the instruction, aren't you entitled to an instruction on your theory of the case?
Absolutely, Your Honor. That's the law in the Commonwealth of Virginia. And there's no reason why that the instruction in this case wasn't given, except that Judge Kasabian made a decision that he didn't think it was necessary. It was an interesting issue in the case that there was much evidence raised in the case that wasn't ferreted out by the Commonwealth either because it wasn't necessary. It was almost as if this case wasn't important to anyone. It wasn't necessary to give instructions to the jury that were vital to their defense. It wasn't necessary to ferret out DNA evidence. Bottom line is, Your Honors, that if the jury had been given the instruction that was originally proposed by the defense, that the burden of proof in this case as to whether or not it was an accidental or an intentional act, which distinguishes for the first time and with the only thing that would have done that for the jury, the difference between an intentional or an accidental act, then the jury at least would have had an understanding that there was a distinction between an accidental and intentional act. I know I had to sit through 3 years of law school and a lot of bar review and years of practice to fully always be able to grapple and understand when it's an accident and when's an intentional act. I think for the jury to be left in the dark and an issue of this vital importance to the defendant's case simply is a miscarriage of justice. I think that in this case, there's no other result that can happen at this point than that this court reverse on the issue of the instruction. And I think that it's significant to note, Your Honor, that in Bryant, where the court specifically talks about impartiality, that there needs to be a level playing field. There needs to at least be instructions given to a jury that don't just put forth all the negative inferences, as Your Honor says, that are about intentionality and deliberate actions, but rather also raise for the jury the issues that the defense has put forth.
Let me take you back a little bit, counsel, and I appreciate you giving us the standard as you see it. And as you point out, although the Commonwealth prevailed at trial, the appropriate standard of review requires that review the evidence with respect to the refused instruction in the light most favorable to the defendant. Boone versus Commonwealth, you're looking good there. But then the Gaines case, Gaines versus Commonwealth, 39 Virginia Appeal 562, says, in spite of this deference to appellant, the judge has broad discretion in giving or denying instructions requested. So it seems like it's a balancing test.
I think that may be the case, Your Honor, when the instruction that is being given or not given in any particular case doesn't relate to an issue that is vital to the defendant's defense. In addition, where the instruction that is being proffered by the defendant is the only instruction on an issue. I think where there's a broad discretion issue is perhaps whether there are additional instructions. I think the case of Mary versus Commonwealth that's cited in the appellant's brief really highlights the issue. That case in particular, Your Honor, dealt with the issue of whether or not the court should grant an instruction, defense proffered instruction, on consent in a rape case. And although in Mary, the Commonwealth had proposed three instructions dealing with force, another dealing with absence of resistance, and another dealing with overbearing of will, none of the instructions specifically, as the court held, dealt with consent. And the court stated that they dealt with consent by inference only, and that it wasn't sufficient to articulate the issue of consent that was vital to the defense. And in that case, the court found that it was error for the court to refuse the consent instruction that the defense had proposed.
Is it your position that the instructions that were given did not cover the principle of law at issue?
Yes, Your Honor. It did not adequately state, they stated the principles of law only by inference. And if we're to be impartial, we have to state both the negative and the positive inferences. That is, in this case, both the Commonwealth's theory that it was deliberate and intentional, as well as the defense theory that it was accidental. To only give one side's theory and not both sides' theory, the language was all one-sided. There was no impartiality in the instructions provided.
It seems like the evolution of the principles that are applicable in these circumstances seem to have suggested that back in the 70s, 80s, 90s, and maybe even early 2000, the defendant would typically win this kind of case because the deference was given to scintilla of evidence, supported by the evidence, making sure the jury understands the principles of law to be applied. But it seems to be sort of shifting to the Commonwealth's favor when the abuse of discretion seems to make its way more prevalently in the discussion of balancing it against these defendant's rights to have his principle of law articulated to the jury. What would be your response to that?
Your Honor, respectfully, I'd say I don't necessarily think that's a good thing for defendants in these cases where they are subject to significant periods of incarceration and deprivation of their liberty to be eroding their rights to have jury instructions, the jury properly charged at the time that they're left with this huge decision as to whether or not to convict somebody in a case like this.
Counsel, you're in your rebuttal time now. You can continue if you choose, or you can save the rest. We've asked you a lot of questions, and I'll give you an extra 30 seconds.
Your Honors, I'll reserve.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right.
Good afternoon, Your Honor.
Afternoon, sir.
Craig Stellar on behalf of the Commonwealth. Your Honor, I agree with most of what counsel has just said regarding what the jury is supposed to be instructed on. The jury should be instructed on all aspects of law that are fairly raised by the evidence. That's clearly a principle that's should be protected, and I believe in this case was protected. Regarding the standard, I think the way to think about this is the defense or the prosecution, depending on who's raising the issue, is entitled to an instruction that would cover all issues fairly raised by the evidence, as long as there's more than a scintilla of evidence to do that. The abuse of discretion happens when an instruction is entitled to be given and is refused. That would be an error of law, which is clearly an abuse of discretion. I think that's how the two issues kind of relate to each other.
And so, in this case, wasn't the theory of the defense an accidental shooting?
It was.
And so weren't they entitled to an accidental shooting instruction?
She was entitled to an instruction that established the Commonwealth had the burden to prove it was an intentional act, which is what the jury was instructed on. Excuse me. And because of that, the jury was instructed on the issues that were fairly raised. The discretion part comes in how the jury's been instructed on those issues.
But the instructions in this case included instruction number 6 that told the jury that they may infer malice from the use of a deadly weapon. Doesn't that wind up clouding this issue of accident, since there was no separate instruction on accident?
I believe the instruction was for the deliberate use of a deadly weapon.
You may infer malice from the, you're right, deliberate use of a deadly weapon.
Again, that goes to the issue of an intentional, deliberate act. And again,
so the defense is having to rely on a negative implication from the jury's understanding?
And that's exactly what happens during closing arguments, Your Honor. The defense attorney will go to the jury and say, this is the instruction, this is what the Commonwealth has to prove. They have to prove a deliberate act. She's testified. What happened was it was a struggle, an accident. There was no deliberate act. You cannot infer malice. That's what happens. The jury, the judge is not required to give the instruction exactly as the defense wants it, as long as the legal issues are presented to the jury to be argued.
Although we don't decide the jury instruction issue on the basis of the question posed by the jury, doesn't the question in this case suggest that there was some confusion on this very point, whether the use of a deadly weapon, a gun, would automatically result in malice?
I don't believe so. The question to me almost raises a factual issue. It's like, okay, if there's a struggle, does that mean it's an accidental or deliberate? It's not really, as a matter of law, what happens. If the court recalled what the instruction the defense was proffering was, essentially, the burden is on the Commonwealth to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the malicious wounding was not accidental. If after considering all the evidence you have a reasonable doubt whether the malicious wounding was accidental or intentional, then you shall find the defendant not guilty.
And before you follow up, you would agree that that is, I'm sorry, I don't like to use pens when I talk. You would agree that that is a proper statement of the law?
Possibly. This has been applied in homicide cases. I'm not aware of any case. Counsel has not cited any cases where it's been applied outside the homicide context. But even assuming arguendo would be applicable to malicious wounding, which I'm not conceding, but just for sake of argument, I believe the issues that were addressed in the proper instructions, the jury was properly instructed on those issues. And that's all that's required. That's where the discretion part comes in. The judge can do it either through an instruction like this, or the way the court felt it did it, by saying, look, the Commonwealth has the burden to prove each element beyond a reasonable doubt, including an intentional act or deliberate act.
I don't know if you were here earlier this morning, but we had another case in which the Commonwealth was arguing about the applicability of an instruction that defined what an assault was. And the Commonwealth wanted an instruction that said that spitting is an assault. So therefore, you can find the defendant guilty if he indeed spat on the victim in this case. And the Commonwealth argued in that case that it was proper for the trial judge to do that. The defendant was arguing that it drew too much attention to what the facts were in the case and should not have been allowed, and the trial court should have just relied on the instructions that were given, which defined what an assault was. And the Commonwealth said, oh no, we need to have this because it helps the jury to understand what the legal basis are for making its determination. What's the difference here?
Well, first of all, I think whether the judge gives it or doesn't give it, I think that's on the appellate review, we're probably stuck with whatever the trial judge did, but I think is the case here. I think as long as the issues are fairly presented to the jury, then the court's met its burden under the law. And that's what the court has done here. I think in the example you've given, had I been the prosecutor, I don't think I would have asked for that specific instruction. I think it's fairly covered by the model instructions. And that's kind of the other issue here. This is not a model instruction. It's based on one, but it's not a model. And a lot of trial judges are reluctant to go outside the model instructions. And if they see some reason, like, look, this issue is fairly addressed, but everything else is addressed. I'm not going to go outside the model instructions and give something that you just created on your own. Granted, it's almost identical to model, but it's still not a model instruction. So that may have been an issue as well. And again, that's the court's discretion. The court knows what instructions it wants to give, it knows how to instruct from the law. And again, the issues that are raised by these proffered instructions were fairly raised and gave counsel every opportunity to argue those issues to the jury. It's not like there's a jury is instructed and they go back and deliberate. Counsel's got a very important duty at closing is to point out why these instructions do or do not match the facts of the case.
Let me ask you this. Suppose a jury, and again, we're speaking in hypotheticals, but I'm just trying to make it make sense because both the arguments are very strong in my view. What if the jury, the question had come back, if we find that the actions involved were an accident, must we find the defendant guilty? What should the trial judge have said?
I think even with that, the judge would be proper in saying you must rely on the instructions that were previously given. If the court wants to give another instruction or both counsel agree separate instruction is appropriate, I think a different instruction would also be appropriate in that case. Again, it's discretion. As long as he accurately defines the law and gives the jury a proper issue is what the legal issues are. However he does that is up to the trial judge. That's the thing that we don't want to be second guessing trial judges based on the exact wording of language that still of instructions that still convey the appropriate legal standard.
You've been around long enough, Mr. Stout, you and I can talk about these things, but there was a time when juries would ask the question, what about parole? You remember the questions back in the day, and the standard response from any good trial judge, don't concern yourself about what happens after you make your decision. We'll do whatever we need to do, whatever the standard instruction was. And we did that for years, and no one thought twice about it until someone took it all the way up to the Supreme Court, and they finally said, no, if the jury's asking you a question regarding a particular and principled area of the law, you just can't say, don't concern yourself about it or consider the instructions that you have. You must answer that question.
So you're referring to the fish bag?
Yes, sir.
In questions we're getting now, I think you see sometimes as juries will say, well, what happens to the time he's already served in jail? And we're still getting the answer now, like, well, don't concern yourself with that. We'll take care of this for consecutive, concurrent time, sentences, that kind of stuff. And that's still issues that are not, certain courts still have not said you have to address that in issue. So, I mean, there are going to be some things that are so prevalent because, I mean, abolishment of parole was kind of a big deal. A lot of people heard about it, so juries are going to be asking the question. Other things are not quite as omnipresent in the juries. And if this was a case where the jury had no inclination that the Commonwealth had the burden to prove an intentional act, I would probably have filed a confession of error. But that's not what happened. The jury was instructed, the Commonwealth has the burden. It has to be an intentional or deliberate act. And that's what the jury found. It's not exactly a Turner situation, but it's similar because they found malicious wounding. They did not find a lawful wound. They did not find a simple assault. They found that she acted deliberately or intentionally. That's what the jury's factual finding was. So it's kind of hard from that factual finding by the jury to come back and say, well, it'd be different if they knew about the Commonwealth had a burden to prove it wasn't an accident. Because they found it wasn't an accident. They said it's an intentional act. It was a deliberate use of the firearm, or that she acted intentionally.
So basically what you would argue is that because of the fact that they found her guilty, it necessarily follows that they did not find that there was an accident.
I would say that because the jury was instructed what the Commonwealth's burden was and that it had to be an intentional act. They did not find an unlawful, but they found a malicious because they were instructed unlawful as well. Since they found the malicious, they did find it to be an intentional and deliberate act. If they had found an unlawful wounding, there might be a little bit more play in what would have happened had this additional instruction been given. But since they didn't go there, they went with the malicious.
What if the evidence supported that the deliberate use of the weapon was to attempt suicide? The instruction would suggest they still have to find malice.
Well, that wasn't the evidence raised by the defendant on the stand. Her testimony was she was contemplating suicide, was making a text, and the husband was attempting to take the gun from her. There may be an argument that's not really an accident, but given the standard, I think that would probably fall under an accident category. That's not her attempting to commit suicide and then missing instructions. That's a separate issue. And I still think suicide is still illegal under the common law, but there's no penalty for it. I think that was abolished. General Assembly doing what they did. But again, I come back to, and I don't want to sound like a broken record, but the jury was instructed on every issue that was proffered. They were told what the burden was, who had the burden, that was the Commonwealth. They were told this had to be an intentional or deliberate act. That's what the jury found. And the judge met its burden. There was no error of law. There was no abuse of discretion. As a result, I'd ask the court to affirm unless the court has any additional questions.
Thank you, counsel. Well presented.
Thank you.
All right, counsel, you got a little bit more in a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just wanted to state that the instruction, although it was not actually a model, is based on the model instruction in homicide cases. And as the petitioner's brief points out, there doesn't seem to be a real reason why there would be a different instruction given in a malicious wounding case, given that the malice is the same in either case. So if the malicious wounding has the intent to kill as one of the elements, why would somebody who has the unfortunate consequence perhaps of an act result in a homicide, and therefore they're entitled to the instruction, presumably because it's one of the models, not be given the instruction when it's fortuitous that there wasn't a murder? It's nonsensical in light of the fact that obviously at some level it was decided that there should be a model instruction for accident, which is exactly why the defendant proposed, the petitioner proposed the instruction in this case, and why we believe it's appropriate. I do believe that regardless of the standard that this court uses to review the denial of the court of this defense proffered instruction, that reversal of this case is appropriate. And we ask your honors to
thank you, counsel. We'll come down and greet counsel.